This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Today, we're asking where the House hearing into the January 6th insurrection goes from here. Lots of you have questions. Here's Anne in Atlanta.
Why were law enforcement agencies so unprepared and slow to respond? Were these agencies given directions in advance to look the other way or not to worry? Who would have contacted them in advance? Thank you.
And many have already shared your answers. Prince is in Arizona, and Richard called us from South Carolina.
I don't see how we can hold anybody else accountable for it after the Senate decided Donald Trump wasn't responsible. If he's not responsible, I don't know who is.
Did they let it happen so that they could really nail Trump on horrible charges? So you figure out what our government's really doing. I don't trust it for a minute.
We're going to make plenty of time for more of your questions and comments in the next hour, and we'll revisit some of the most powerful moments from earlier this week. We'll speak to the lawyer who's representing two of the four police officers who testified. But first, let's go to a reporter whose every waking hour seems to be dominated by what we're learning about the attack. Scott McFarlane is NBC4's Washington investigative reporter based here in the nation's capital. Scott, welcome to 1A.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive headlong into this week's political push for answers, where are we with the criminal investigation into January 6th?
Some great progress to report. We're at about 550 federal cases so far. The FBI director has indicated there could be hundreds more to come. So we're making headway. But if you look deeply at the cases and where they stand, still feels like we're closer to the starting line than the finish line. We have sentences, closure in just two cases so far, two cases of note. There are plea agreements in a few dozen cases, less than 10%. And in the higher tier cases, where the more serious charges are alleged, conspiracy, assault, there have been a few plea agreements, and those defendants have agreed to talk to help the feds. Those are a small minority. There's a long way to go. And the more provocative question that I'm wrestling with is, where is this headed? I mean, these defendants who are flipping, these top line defendants who are agreeing to help, who are they flipping? What are they offering?
How are the authorities handling the evidence? We've seen more video footage during the hearings, things we hadn't seen before. It seems like there's a lot of evidence to try to gather.
An unprecedented amount of evidence to gather, you know, thousands of hours of video, and defense attorneys want to see it all. There are thousands of phone devices, more than 250,000 tips. I mean, this is, as the Justice Department says, the largest criminal investigation in U.S. history. And the Justice Department and the court system are trying to figure out how to navigate that, because all of this is funneling through the Washington, D.C. federal courthouse, which coincidentally, it's pretty close to Capitol Hill and the U.S. Capitol itself. And that courthouse, according to my reporting, has about 300, 400 criminal cases a year. Right now, as of today, they're dealing with 550 insurrection cases alone, not to mention all the backlog from COVID and the cases that were stalled last year. So they're trying to figure out how to prevent bottlenecks and, you know, true stalemates in these important cases.
Where do you expect most of the new information about the insurrection to come from? Are we going to get it from the courts, or is it going to come from Congress?
So we're going to get a lot of information from the courts when we find out who did what on site that day. We'll find out things we don't know. I know we've seen a lot of video and heard a lot of sounds, but there's an awful lot we don't know about what happened inside the complex. But that's just the criminal activity on the grounds. There's a bigger picture and a bigger question. You know, who sent this mob? Whose idea was it? Was it somebody's idea to have these people breach security, breach the doors, assault police, and attempt to kidnap and kill members of Congress? Or was it organic? And the Justice Department investigation is not going to necessarily give us good answers to that question. That's kind of the purview of Congress. And we got a taste of that this week when those brave police officers testified about their experiences. And though those stories were emotional, they were powerful, they were telling, they're still just a narrow glimpse of what happened that day. Although I was most struck by what was said at the end when, you know, Officer Harry Dunn bravely said, you know, we got to find out who sent the hitman, who sent the mob.
Let's hear part of the opening statement from one of the two Republicans on the House Select Committee. This is Liz Cheney.
We cannot leave the violence of January 6th and its causes uninvestigated. The American people deserve the full and open testimony of every person with knowledge of the planning and preparation for January 6th. We must know what happened here at the Capitol. We must also know what happened every minute of that day in the White House. Every phone call, every conversation, every meeting leading up to, during, and after the attack. Honorable men and women have an obligation to step forward. If those responsible are not held accountable, and if Congress does not act responsibly, this will remain a cancer on our constitutional republic, undermining the peaceful transfer of power at the heart of our democratic system. We will face the threat of more violence in the months to come and another January 6th every 4 years. I have been a conservative Republican since 1984 when I first voted for Ronald Reagan. I've disagreed sharply on policy and politics with almost every Democratic member of this committee. But in the end, we are one nation under God.
Again, that's Republican Liz Cheney, Wyoming's Congresswoman. Scott, take us inside the Select Committee room. Did it feel any different than a normal committee hearing?
This bared no resemblance to any committee hearing I've ever covered. I've covered a few hundred of them, if not a couple thousand of them over the years. This was so different, in part because we didn't have the normal awkward, amorphous setup of a congressional hearing. I mean, congressional hearings are like the worst way to investigate things because it goes back and forth in halting starts and stops, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican. They lose focus. They diverge. They bring up irrelevant things. Congressional hearings can be tricky to cover, summarize, or even watch. This was so different. This was compelling testimony from four people with visceral, emotive things to say. So it was easy to listen to. I mean, it was hard to listen to. It was easy to understand. Then you had members of Congress who clearly worked in conjunction with each other to avoid being redundant, to avoid, you know, losing focus. It was intense. It was powerful, but it was focused. So this was different. And when I walked through the room before the hearing, I noticed these huge projection screen TVs throughout the hearing room, which made clear they're going to show videos. They're going to show images. And you saw those videos. I didn't see anything new that I hadn't seen already in those videos. Those were court exhibits that we've been looking at for weeks. But when you synthesize them all together, man, it's powerful. And it struck me again, even though I'd seen those videos hundreds of times.
We'll talk about security vulnerabilities later in the hour. We also got this text from Louisville. We need to reimagine and update laws and systems to address this type of insurrection led by a sitting president as well as those in Congress. More from you. Plus, we speak to the lawyer who's representing two of the four police officers who testified on Tuesday.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Audible. Chasing Ghislaine is a new investigative podcast series from executive producer James Patterson and hosted by veteran journalist Vicky Ward, who has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for nearly 20 years. Epstein's story intertwines with the disgraced heiress Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's ex-lover, former employee, and alleged co-conspirator. Chasing Ghislaine is available exclusively on Audible. To start listening, go to audible.com/chasing.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is back. This season is all about investing. We've got stories of big bets, bubble spotting, and cute animals, too. Every Wednesday till Labor Day from NPR's Planet Money.
Today, we're asking where the House hearing into the January 6th insurrection goes from here. Now, let's bring in two new voices. Mark Zaid is a national security attorney representing two of the four U.S. Capitol Police officers who testified at Tuesday's hearing. Mark, it's great to have you back on 1A.
Thank you. It is always a pleasure to be on 1A.
And Quinta Jurassic. She's a senior editor for Lawfare, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a contributing writer for The Atlantic. Quinta, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mark, first, just what's the nature of your representation of these Capitol Police officers?
So I started representing Officer Dunn already 6 months ago, not too long after the insurrection happened. And I generally represent federal whistleblowers and journalists and other federal employees to make sure they do things the right way. And Officer Dunn wanted to speak out about what he had experienced. And I wanted to help him be able to do that without running afoul of any Capitol Police rules, regulations, laws, etc. So I really have been there to be a legal shield for him and help him coordinate what he wants to do and do it properly. So we made sure we got authorization from the Capitol Police, and everything that he and now Sergeant Gunnell has done has been done with the authorization of the Capitol Police. So that means they get to share their experiences with everyone, and they still get to keep their jobs.
Well, let's hear part of the testimony from Officer Harry Dunn. This is what they told Officer Dunn when he told the insurrectionists to leave the building.
No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here. We're here to stop the steal. Joe Biden is not the president. Nobody voted for Joe Biden. I'm a law enforcement officer, and I do my best to keep politics out of my job. But in this circumstance, I responded, well, I voted for Joe Biden. Does my vote not count? Am I nobody? That prompted a torrent of racial epithets. One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, you hear that, guys? This nigger voted for Joe Biden. Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, boo, f-. No one had ever called me a nigger while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer.
Mark, what does Officer Dunn want this committee to do?
Well, I think they all want a level of accountability. And it's not about recognition. I think one or more of them said it's not about recognition or awards for themselves. Frankly, they did their job. They would do their job like that any day. And if it ever happens again, which hopefully it never will, they'll do their job. And they were there to protect Democrats and Republicans alike, the members, the vice president, all of their staffs that were there. But they want the truth. They are incredibly bothered by the distortions and the disinformation that are being perpetrated by individuals like former President Trump and other actual sitting members of Congress and media pundits on a particular side. But most of all, like any law enforcement officers, they want accountability, and anyone who broke the law should be duly punished.
These officers have been subjected to continual abuse and harassment, threats for speaking out. As their lawyer, how are they doing?
It is a trying day, each and every day. I think Officer Fanone of the Metropolitan Police Department talked about how he had been diagnosed with PTSD. I believe Sergeant Gunnell said from his days in Iraq with the U.S. Army, he had been diagnosed with PTSD. This has only compounded it. Officer Dunn is seeking mental health counseling and encouraged all of his fellow officers to do so. Every time they recount it, it revives it for them, but they know that's a necessary act to do because of how important this is. So one of the things Officer Dunn, in fact, asked for the committee to do is to look at how are all the officers doing? Actually, not just even for MPD or Capitol Police, but any of the other federal agencies who responded. How are all of them doing emotionally, mentally? Are they getting enough mental health counseling, which I can tell you they're not? Are they getting enough leave to be able to address their mental health counseling, which I can tell you they're not. So that is going to be really important for all of them. But it is a struggle, and I do have concerns about any of the officers that were there that day.
Quinta, let's get into some of the politics and first hear from one more officer who testified on Tuesday. This is Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone.
My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience. Being an officer, you know your life is at risk whenever you walk out the door, even if you don't expect otherwise law-abiding citizens to take up arms against you. But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day, and in doing so, betray their oath of office. Those very members whose lives, offices, staff members, I was fighting so desperately to defend. I agreed to speak here today and have talked publicly about what happened because I don't think our response to the insurrection should have anything to do with political parties.
Quinta, we know there's a ton of politics surrounding these hearings, but how is the committee positioning itself politically?
I think it's important that there are two Republicans on the committee. So, of course, Representative Liz Cheney was appointed by House Majority, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who also appointed Representative Adam Kinzinger after House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy pulled the other Republicans he had wanted from the committee. And I think that helps the committee give itself sort of a bipartisan sheen. Obviously, there aren't pro-Trump Republicans on the committee, but it allows them to sort of say, we represent a coalition of Americans who are, you know, cross-ideological, cross-party, and who are all appalled by the events of January 6th. And by the sort of illiberal turn that Trump took American politics. I think that's really important, and it's going to allow the committee to sort of maybe give itself some political top cover, be able to say counter pro-Trump Republican arguments that it's, you know, just Nancy Pelosi going after Donald Trump. I also think it's very important that, you know, as we've been discussing, the committee chose to start its investigation with a hearing with four law enforcement witnesses. I think that the testimony was incredibly powerful as we've heard the clips. I was pretty shaken by it in a way I hadn't expected. And I think that being able to, you know, point to the testimony of those four law enforcement officers, that allows the committee to sort of say, we are conducting this investigation in part on behalf of these officers. We are, you know, backing them up. This is not a political hit job. This is something that we want to do to support, you know, these sort of representations of the best of America, if that makes sense. And that is a very powerful message. And it seemed to me that Chairman Benny Thompson, who's leading the committee, was very intentionally sort of using that to potentially position the committee for an aggressive investigatory posture going forward.
Now, Mark, as one of these officers, as their attorney, is part of your legal strategy to do whatever you can to make sure the House, the Justice Department takes seriously these calls to prosecute lawmakers who may have had a hand in this insurrection?
I'm not sure I would go that far, particularly because these are Capitol police officers. I mean, we have really made a concerted effort to try and stay out of the political fray. I mean, remember, these officers guard these members of Congress, Republican and Democrat. And so there have been few comments, frankly, where the officers have spoken out about, my officers have spoken out about specific members of Congress. In fact, we've always tried to avoid commenting on anything with respect to a particular comment other than maybe generically the comment. And that's because we don't want to jeopardize their ability to do their job. Or, not that I have any concern about their ability to do their job, I'm concerned about the perception. And obviously those on the extreme sides, doesn't matter which, can distort that perception very easily, and we want to avoid that. So I do handle their interactions with the Department of Justice. They are asked to identify photographs of individuals to see if they might recall their actions. And there are several individuals who are being prosecuted, particularly for their attacks on Sergeant Gunnell. And we will most certainly play a role in that and cooperate however the U.S. government needs them to.
We're getting the latest on the investigation into the attack on the U.S. Capitol back in January. This is 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Now let's get back to today's conversation and more of your questions about the investigation into the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. So let's talk more about where this investigation is going, and despite recent removal of fencing from around the Capitol building, how vulnerable Congress might be to another attack. Scott, you alluded to this earlier, but from a law enforcement perspective, how much has changed on the ground since January 6th?
I was really struck when Officer Dunn testified this week that he felt more vulnerable with that fencing gone. When the fencing was taken down, the fencing was not popular in the Washington, D.C. community, but the people who live and work here. Wasn't popular among some members of Congress, but it was effective. It was a deterrent. Just the optics of it were difficult. And Officer Dunn made clear he had some concerns with it coming down, at least at the time it did. And that was telling to me. The officers are operating shorthanded. They are 200 to 300 fewer officers than they're authorized to have at U.S. Capitol Police. They're trying to recruit. They're actively recruiting. Thing is, they're recruiting from the same pool of candidates as every other police department in this region and in this country. And right now, police recruitment is a difficult art. So they're fighting an uphill battle to fill those spots. They have an awful lot more money to grow this department, to make it more secure in the long term, not the short term. But where do they find the people to come work for this department?
Well, and Scott, specifically around the concerns about white supremacist organizations and the threat they present to our national security, is that still being centered in this conversation?
We've started to hear the phrase domestic terror more. In fact, it came up during the first sentencing in a felony case on January 6th. We heard the prosecutors say that defendant was part of an act of domestic terror. White supremacy, haven't seen that phrase in the court filings, at least not much, and I've read a few thousands of them. Haven't seen that fixation during hearings on the threat of white supremacy, its role in January 6th, and the threat moving forward. But the conversation is now including the words domestic terror more often, which underscores something, a concern by the Justice Department, if not the entire federal government, that domestic terror is a threat to the Capitol, to the complex moving forward.
Quinta, what's your understanding of the role the Justice Department has to play here?
I think it's a big question. Confining ourselves just to the congressional investigation, there's going to be an interesting dynamic between the Justice Department and the committee. The committee has, shown that it's interested in digging more into the details of what happened at the White House on January 6th and in the days before that. Part of that may be, what communications there were between the White House and the Justice Department. And so as part of that, there's going to be a question of how solicitous the Justice Department is going to be to the committee's requests for information, whether, documents, emails, communications, or testimony from current or former officials from the Trump administration. I was definitely in the camp of people who was potentially concerned that the department might, try to preserve its own authority, the authority of the executive branch, and maybe play a little hard to get to the committee's requests. I do think it's important to note that the department earlier this week indicated that it would give the okay to testimony from some former Justice Department officials, including Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, to testify to other congressional committees about Trump's efforts to overturn the election. That indicates that maybe we should expect maybe a little more openness on the part of the department to acceding to demands from the committees. But that's something that I think is really important to keep on our eyes on going forward in terms of what role the department is playing, again, even outside the realm of criminal prosecutions, but just looking at how it fits into the congressional investigation.
I want to go back to this text from earlier. It reads, "It will be critical to develop a well-thought-out and well-tested rapid response plan to provide the Capitol Police and others with the support required should another major incident develop. Thinking outside of the boxes required, nothing should be unforeseen." Quinta, what signs, if any, are you seeing that the laws are being changed to take away some of the unwritten codes of conduct in our elections processes?
I think it's a hugely important question. We've been seeing a lot of movement in Republican state houses on the state level, sort of moving to give officials more power over the vote counting process. There's a bill that listeners may have heard about in Georgia that is really potentially concerning here for politicizing sort of the integrity of the election after the votes have been cast. There has been a lot of conversation about this among sort of people who are concerned. One of the proposals that's been put forward is that Congress should think about amending the Electoral Count Act, which is the legislation that led to Congress being assembled to certify the electoral vote on January 6th. The argument being that currently the law allows members of Congress to, you know, stand up and raise objections to the counting, which is exactly what we saw happen on January 6th by many Republican members of Congress. So that's one option. There are others. I think there definitely hasn't been a lot of discussion in Congress of the need to reform that law just yet, perhaps because it would be a difficult political lift. And I will say that it's not clear to me that the committee itself, the Select Committee investigating January 6th, will be looking into these questions. That's not to say that it shouldn't. I think it's obviously immediately relevant to what they're doing. But we have to keep in mind that, you know, they have a really limited time frame. Potentially the committee investigation could only last through this term of Congress if Democrats lose the House. And so I do wonder whether these very important issues will sort of have to take a seat a little bit to the side of the core issues of what exactly it was that happened on the 6th.
Scott, what are you watching in the weeks ahead?
Plea deals in high-level cases. Do we get other big defendants to plead? And if so, did they cooperate?
Thanks to NBC reporter Scott McFarlane, Mark Zaid, a national security attorney who's representing two of the U.S. Capitol Police officers who testified at Tuesday's hearing, and Quinta Jurassic. She's a senior editor for Lawfare, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and contributing writer for The Atlantic. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.